Hi, I'm Alan, a food addict.
Hi, Alan.
And if we could just start with a serenity prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done. So first, thank you for coming today. So the focus today is going to be about relapse prevention, so that if you're abstinent and want to stay abstinent, to increase the likelihood of that. I'm going to do a combination of things. I'm going to first start by just telling a little bit about my personal story to qualify. Then I'm going to talk about how I was involved in a relapse prevention support group for a number of years and kind of what we learned, what the process is. And then after that, I'm going to give you time to actually go through some worksheets and look for some relapse warning signs that you may be having. And then we're going to get together in small groups and kind of process that and then just come back together in the end. There'll be a break in the middle, kind of around the writing time to get water or go to the bathroom or stuff like that. So let me start with just some of my OA background. So just the basic statistics, my top physical weight was 335 pounds, so I'm keeping off about 150 pounds. I've been in OA, and this was my 30th year in OA. I came in 89. And I wish I could tell you I've been abstinent 30 years. I've not, but I've been abstinent about 25 of the 30 years. I've had several relapses. The most longest continuous abstinence was about 14 and a half years. Now I have a little over 4 years. So I know abstinence and I know relapse because I've had some significant relapses. And so I feel like, you know, I can speak from both perspectives. Just a little bit about my OA story. I have what is often described as a high trauma life story, honestly. There's this term called adverse childhood experiences. It's a new term psychologists use, something like 1 to 10. And 10 is like, you know, you live in Syria, you've been barrel bombed, your entire family's dead, and you're handicapped, and, you know, like as bad can get. So I was rated as a 7 on that 1 to 10 scale, which is kind of on the high end for our culture. A little bit about what that looked like is that, first I had gross obesity in my family. My mother died of a heart attack, 100 pounds overweight. My father was grossly obese. Different family members were all grossly obese, just all over the place. So I sort of came into the eat too much, you know, DNA, so to speak. And then my parents split up when I was an infant, and I only saw my dad once in my life. My mother struggled with clinical depression, maybe other stuff too, wasn't that clear back then. What that meant is she couldn't hold a job. So with no father and a mother that couldn't hold a job, we ended up in public assistance, welfare in what would be called public projects in New York City. And I was about the only white person in my neighborhood, and it was a high violent, high crime neighborhood. And I can tell you that I was physically beaten up, almost killed multiple times, like being hit in the head with a baseball bat and having a concussion and almost brain damage. Just multiple times, just, you know, almost a broken jaw from being hit in the face, things like that, like a very high violence place. I feared literally to go to school each day. I would like plot routes to try to not get beat up going to school. It was that kind of a thing. Just being a fat little white kid in a very different looking neighborhood. And then beyond that, my mother's depression accelerated and she had multiple suicide attempts, and she got to a certain point where she was asking me to kill myself with her. So I can remember being 12 years old and my mother would literally hand me a bottle of sleeping pills. She would tell me why life was hopeless, we were poor, there was violence, there was no hope, and the best thing we should do is just end this life and go to sleep. And she would hand me a glass of water, and I would literally beg for my life, literally as a child, just begging that I didn't want to die, that I didn't want her to die. And very quickly I learned there was this thing called the candy store, the ice cream shop, the refrigerator, and that became my way to cope. And quite honestly, I'm happy that I used food as a child, because I'm alive. If I had taken her advice, I wouldn't be here today. So long story short, I was fat from kind of day one, husky, chubby, teased for being fat, you know. I was, 200 pounds by the time I was 14. I probably should have weighed like 120 or something like that, you know. When I was 13, my mother overdosed on the sleeping pills. It was her third or fourth suicide attempt. She didn't die, but back then, if you had too many suicide attempts, you lose guardianship of your child. So she lost guardianship. She went into a psychiatric hospital, kind of this snake pit place, and she was never my mother again. And I ended up going into a foster home with strangers, another part of the country. There was alcoholism there. There was some violence. It was a pretty rough place as well. But I quickly learned that the only thing that actually made me feel okay besides food was getting approval from school. That if a teacher said, A, good job, something like that, it was like the sense of okayness, right? I did something good, you know? And so I worked hard to get good grades in school. And I graduated high school at 16, and I got a scholarship to an Ivy League university. And I just thought, I'm gonna escape this, escape the foster home, my mother, all this insanity here. I've got a ticket to a better life. And the first thing I discovered at college was unlimited food. You know, you go into this cafeteria, you swipe your thing, and you can eat as much as you want. And I just went crazy. You know, I remember coming back to a food, to the table with the other college students, and I had this tray with like three sets of meals on it. I remember a student said, did you bring food for the whole table? And I was like, no, this is all mine. I was like a shameless overeater. You know, there was no hiding it. And long story short, I doubled my weight. I gained 170 pounds in 4 years of college. I didn't go to classes. Like literally, I once went 8 weeks without attending a single class, not taking, handing in a paper, not taking exams. I got put on academic probation. I was almost expelled. It was, you know, and I discovered alcohol and marijuana and other ways of acting out, and it was kind of a disaster. I'm just gonna pass around some photos. This is kind of what I looked like when I got out of school at 335 pounds. So there's just some mixed photos in there. Somehow pictures of my dog always get in, but if you ever watched her eat, she qualifies. You know. So in any case, I came out of college, and a few years later, someone took me to an OA meeting. Actually, I went to one OA meeting when I was 20, and I walked in, and everyone else was in their 50s. They were all women. And they were talking about Christianity and how Jesus Christ had saved them, and I freaked. I wasn't Christian, I wasn't a woman, I wasn't in my 50s, and it was like, wow, this is... So I ran away and came back 7 years later, but when I was 27, somebody took me to a meeting. It was the day after Thanksgiving, and people started telling stories about their crazy eating, you know, their incredible binging, and I related. You know, like I remember one guy shared about being at restaurants and eating food that had been bussed from other people's tables, was sitting like on those trays to be thrown in the garbage, and kind of grabbing things off of it, you know? And I'd done that. I had like grabbed pieces of like food at diners and pizza places off of, you know, which is like really disgusting, right? Like you wouldn't tell anyone that you're doing that. It's pretty as disgusting as food shit gets, but people said that, and it's like, oh wow, so people told other binge-a-logs, right? Eating food out of garbage cans, hiding food in garbage cans, stealing food, shoplifting food. And I was like, wow, I am not the only one that is nuts with food. You know, I knew other people were fat, that's obvious, but I didn't know exactly how they got there. I just knew how I got there. And so I kept coming back because there was that common bond of craziness over food. And then people started sharing like really personal things, things about what their marriage is, their divorce, being abused as a child, you know, like all these things that, you know, I'd never heard people share before. And so I started doing the same thing. And, you know, before OA, I had never told a soul that my mother used to kill myself and went into a psychiatric hospital, used to ask me to kill myself and went into a psychiatric hospital. Who would you tell that to if you weren't in therapy? Like who would you share that with, you know? I had never told a soul that I was sexually molested as a child. Again, if you weren't in therapy, who would you tell that to, right? And so all of a sudden there was this safe space where people shared really vulnerable, intimate things with acceptance, without judgment, without anything, you know? And I often say, if OA was nothing more than a bunch of people who tried to eat healthy and shared with each other what really was going on, that would like be worth half the price of admission. Like that in itself was incredibly healing, you know? But I learned there was, you know, was more to it. And I sometimes say, you know, they use the term like gateway drug, marijuana is a gateway drug. Well, I feel like OA was a gateway to recovery. Because like once I started to share these things, people would say, you know, we really can't help you that you were sexually molested as a child. But there's something called Survivors of Incest Anonymous. There's something called therapy, you know, and I would get pointed to other things. And so it became like a platform to get into therapy and other 12-step programs, you know, because people just said, wow, you need lots of help. Like we can help with the food, you know, hopefully, but you know, there's other places to go. So it just became like this gateway to getting into recovery in many different forms. So when I got into OA, I was quickly told there was this thing called the 12 steps, you know, so I was like, okay, sign me up. And I got a sponsor that you might call these days a Vision for You or a Big Book Thumper type sponsor, but he was all about the first 164 pages, let's study it. Was that a comma or a semicolon? What was Bill thinking? Let's discuss it, you know. And I kind of went through that, and it was really good. I worked the steps pretty thoroughly. I had like 75 ninth step amends that took years to do, but finally got done. And then I also got guided into this thing called HOW, which is a structured OA. It's HOW, maybe you know, is like OA that's very tool-centric, a lot of weighing and measuring of food and stuff. And I got into that, and I sort of did both for a while, which was good because I really needed like an OA boot camp of, you know, like steps and tools, and that was really good. So now let me shift a little bit to relapse. So my first relapse happened when I was about a little under 2 years abstinent. I'd worked through the steps a fair amount. I was in HOW working a pretty solid program, and I was at goal weight. So like, you know, and I was a little bit like, oh, I've got this, you know, I've worked the steps, I've made amends, I'm at goal weight, like I could graduate, you know. And then what happened was my sponsor, a guy I liked, he was from Annapolis, who was harder to get male sponsors, he went into relapse, and he called me up one day and said, I'm in relapse, you should probably get another sponsor. And I was like, well, but I really like you, I trust you, we talk every day, you know, I don't care if you're in relapse. And he said, okay. You know, so I started with having a sponsor who was gaining weight and eating. Still a nice guy trying to help me, but you know. And then I was like, you know, do I really need 3 meetings a week? Maybe I can do 2, you know. And I said to him, what if I don't do an assignment every day? He goes, yeah, fine with me, you know. And slowly, I started to do less and less of program. You know, there's that term, death by 1,000 cuts. And I felt like my abstinence got dismantled one micro step at a time. You know, I mean, I would, you know, like, okay, boy, I was making 3 phone calls a day. That's time consuming. How about 1 a day? Oh, that's working. Okay, maybe every other day. Do I even need to make phone calls? You know, and it was just subtle. It was a few months of just degrading my program. And what I always remember is I would also rationalize food more and more. You know, I was like, oh, that's probably okay. You know, sugar 5th or beyond, 4th or beyond, 3rd or beyond, you know, like just little things. What I always remember the most is calling in my food, and I said I was going to have onion rings. And he said, well, that's not on your food plan. I said, well, sure, it's onions. It's a vegetable. You know, it does have a little bread and oil around it, but it's a vegetable. And my sponsor relapsed said, works for me, you know. And, you know, it's kind of humorous, but in my mind, I really thought that meant vegetable, you know, like that meant vegetable, even though it was like, you know, 1 calorie of onion and 100 calories of covering, you know, per onion ring, you know. So it was that process, and eventually my relapse went into what I would call full-blown hell, and I started binging daily, like severe, you know, industrial strength, quart of ice cream, Häagen-Dazs, an entire pizza from Domino's, like industrial strength binging. And I gained 30 pounds in 30 days. You know, I mean, I was just like daily could see my belt notches changing and the clothes back to the old clothes, like a hellish relapse. And a few people in HOW, when we were, HOW's a very close-knit community, if you know HOW, because you make all these phone calls and sponsor each other and stuff, were really scared for me that I was in that kind of a relapse, you know. And so they did what I call an intervention. 7 of them met with me, and they said, you know, we are really scared for you. Maybe you need to go to residential treatment. And they knew of a place that was 12-step based, very OA focused, and they helped me figure out how to do the insurance, which they actually covered back then. And I went off for 30 days at a treatment center in Florida. I won't mention it, not to sponsor some outside place, but it was quite helpful. It was a forced abstinence. You know, they gave me 3 meals a day, healthy. That was it. Their fridge was locked between meals, you know, with a big lock. So, you know, there was nothing but clean abstinence there. You know, you went to an OA meeting every day. You worked on the steps. You read literature. You know, they had therapy. It was like, you know, kind of what I needed, and I was grateful to go to it. And then I came back, and I jumped right back into doing HOW, you know, to keep it going. Interestingly enough, there was about 30 of us when I was there, I would call it my class of my treatment colleagues, and we all kept in touch. And 1 year later, only two of us out of the 30 were still abstinent. You know, and I learned a lot of people just thought, well, they got it, you know, they went home and thought they were like, you know, okay, and they weren't. So it's, you know, it's really a disease that requires constant maintenance and constant recovery. So in any case, just sort of move into the relapse part of it in the process. There's been like a lot of research on alcohol relapse, alcoholism, you know, like there's all these medical studies and NIH and stuff. And one of the researchers is a guy named Terry Gorski, and he's just well established in having done alcoholism studies. And he started to learn that people don't just suddenly have 10 years of sobriety and one day pick up the drink. That there's this whole process of things that go on, you know, like relapse is a process, you know. I always like to say relapse is a process, not an event, you know. It's like you go there, that alcohol or food is the last thing to go. So this guy did all these studies, long-term studies on alcoholics and what caused them to relapse, and was, you know, kind of the guru in that. Well, one of the guys at the treatment center, one of the food addiction therapists, had studied Gorski's work and been to different things with Gorski and said, this could work with food. It's the same thing, more or less. And so there were a few of us who had been to this treatment center, and one lady organized to fly this therapist into Virginia from Florida for a weekend. And he spent a weekend with us teaching us how to do relapse warning signs and what to do. And you know, it was wonderful. This guy really was like state of the art at the time. And it was such a powerful weekend, we said, you know, we should start a process of meeting monthly to, you know, just try to help ourselves. And so we did that, and it was incredibly successful. I think more than half of the people in that group broke over 20 years of continuous abstinence, and one gal is at 25, and I think one woman's about to hit 30 years. So it was a really good process, at least from our little cohort of, you know, a half dozen or so. So I just felt kind of passionate to try to pass it on. And a couple of years ago, I was asked to talk about it at Region 7, so this is kind of the same thing. Let me start here. Okay, so there's two principles of relapse prevention and three goals. First principle is, and I'm going to give these out later, but if I hand things out now, people just read and I think it's better to hear. There are predictable warning signs that precede relapse, that it is predictable, and that relapse can be prevented if we learn to recognize the warning signs and manage the warning signs. You know, that you need to recognize them and then manage and take action so that they don't progress. That's the basic principle. And then there's three goals to the actual thing. The first one is to identify your relapse warning signs, and people are different. You know, for me, eating this may be horrific. For you, that's like, oh, that's okay. You know, like everyone's different. So you have to identify your own personal relapse warning signs. What are your indicators? Secondly, learn how to manage the warning signs as they occur, or excuse me, learn how to recognize them. Sorry, learn how to recognize them. Like, oh, I know my warning signs, one. Two, I recognize I'm having one of them, or two of them, or three of them. Recognize them. And then third, how to manage them. When they come up, what to do without using food. You know, what to do without picking up. And so that's the management of it. So it kind of falls into four buckets of warning signs, you could say. One is what I call OA program warning signs, things where in your OA program you're not doing the things that, you know, have worked for you. The second is food or physical warning signs, choices you're making in your food. Third is what I call emotional spiritual, where your inner state is off, so you're at risk of picking up. And fourth is life events or triggers, things that are happening in your life that do it. So I'll just kind of briefly walk through it and give you this sheet, and then later on you'll be sort of coming up with your own, but this may touch, you know, for some of you. For OA, it's pretty straightforward. Going to less meetings or no meetings, if meetings works for you. Less or no contact with your sponsor. Stalled on your steps. You know, a lot of people, they kind of come in, work step one, step two, but don't progress. Or not doing maintenance steps. That's an easy one. Like, you've worked through the steps, you know, and for those of you who may not know those terms, 10, 11, and 12 are called the maintenance steps that helps you maintain abstinence. Not making or returning phone calls or texts, you know, not staying connected. They say this is a disease of isolation, and if you're isolating, you're moving toward the disease. leaving meetings early or coming late, you know, so there's really not as much connection, and I can remember having done that myself. Not sponsoring, you know, not kind of helping others. Little or no service. Not reading literature. Not following the traditions. Not having action plans. OA added action plans as a tool a few years back, and they did it for a good reason. Like, plans on how to act to stay abstinent are key. Like, it's not, you don't haphazardly be abstinent. You do things with a plan. And they call it an action plan because it's not just something you think about doing, but it's something you act on. They're key words, planning and action. They're great words. Reducing self-care routines. You know, I've come to believe that recovery sort of falls down to two things, structure and support. Structure are things you do that you do on a regular basis. They're structured, they're organized, they happen at times and certain dates. That's structure. And if you're not able to keep to that structure, then you need support. Support is usually other human beings providing accountability, feedback, you know, care, concern. So if it's not working, typically you need more structure or more support. That's kind of what it comes down to. And then less prayer and meditation. You know, for a lot of people, having this sense of connection with, you know, a higher power, God, whatever, however it manifests, is so key. So that's examples of your OA program, things where they can start to get at it. Physically, food. So everyone's different on that, but eating between meals for some people is an indicator. Portion creep. I have this thing called, I call about, you know, expanding precedence. You know, like I make a precedent and I go, oh, you know what? I can have the bigger apple, the bigger this, the bigger that. And then that becomes like the new baseline. You know, and the next time, I remember I had a nutritionist who said, you know, as long as it's one apple, you're good. And I found these roadside stands, I swear to God, they had 2-pound apples. They were like red pumpkins, you know? And literally, it was unbelievable. They didn't taste very good, but boy, are they big. You know, so like, all of a sudden I was like, you know what? I think you need to weigh your apples, you know? So just kind of expanding precedence. Turning red and yellow light foods into green light foods, you know, like just again, and again, if you don't know that terminology, red is foods that you figured out are completely addictive for you. Yellow, they're fuzzy sometimes, and green are good. But, you know, if you rationalize that, eating out more than normal, that's...
Can you speak up a little more?
Oh, sure. Sure, eating out more than normal. Yeah, if anyone can't hear me, just go like that. Use of alcohol, if, you know, can be for people. Use of recreational drugs, right? Marijuana is becoming more and more legal, but, you know, when I get high, I want to eat afterwards so I don't get high anymore, because marijuana munchies, just not good. Other reasons I don't do it, too. Other addictive substances and behaviors, cigarettes or sex or gambling, whatever, but if you're riding other addictions, it's typically not good. Obsessed with free foods, you know, like sugar-free gum, diet soda, sweeteners, soda. I've heard more people tell their stories of gum insanity and Diet Coke insanity and coffee. Not measuring foods you used to measure. Excessively weighing yourself. I've heard of people weighing themselves multiple times a day. You know, they're just obsessed with that scale. So that's examples of physical relapse warning signs. Emotional, and again, this is just a possible list, obviously, a loss of your higher power connection, ongoing resentments, where you just keep getting more and more angry about whatever, untreated depression. I struggle with a mood disorder, and when my depression was really bad, at least two of my relapses were directly linked to depression. That if you can't get out of bed, about the only thing you can get to is the refrigerator, you know? It's the one thing that everyone will get to, at least I will. Feeling alienated from your religion of choice, or having a spiritual crisis, insomnia, oh my goodness, right, if you're not sleeping right, you're just fragile and so easy, or you're in the middle of the night, what a good thing to do, go to the refrigerator, right? Anxiety issues, mental health issues, medication side effects, they can do all sorts of things to us. Not getting correct medication or emotional support. For me, I needed therapy. There was no way I was going to deal with my childhood without good therapy. Health issues that can affect your emotions, like if you're an exerciser but you have had a knee surgery and now you can't walk or jog for weeks, but that exercise used to help you, then wait a second. Anything else, really anything that messes with your serenity. You know, anything that if you're not feeling quite right on the inside, food is the best tool, many of us know. So those are examples of emotional, spiritual. And the last category is life events or triggers, just stuff that happens in life. In my own case, I went through a divorce in 2008, and oh my God, you know, I thought I was going to be with this woman forever. I didn't have family. Her family became my family. I had in-laws and uncles and aunts and cousins. I had this whole clan for like 7 years. And one day they were gone, like they were all gone. And I was just like devastated beyond devastated, you know? And I ended up falling into relapse. I didn't quite get what a big deal it was to lose your entire family, particularly in my case where that was the only family I had. So, you know, that was a life trigger that took me right into the refrigerator. You know, financial issues, health issues around your loved ones, travel, particularly to new places. I recently spent 3 weeks in Asia, and boy, it was a high-risk thing. It was like food was different, and so many things were different. I figured out in 21 days, I ate out 52 times, you know, because of what was going on. And I was amazed. I came back the same weight, in fact, a couple pounds less. But I had to do a lot of work to research how I was going to work OA on the other side of the planet in a place where there's no OA meetings and the menus are in another language. You know, that was pretty challenging. But and so, you know, some of these things, you see them coming. You may not see a divorce coming, but you see a trip coming. Holiday challenges, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you know, that whole thing. What do they call it? The trifecta of food addiction, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, you know. A move, pregnancy, infant care, various kinds of breakup, elder care issues. I hear so many stories about elder care issues. Family members having problems, your children, death of a loved one. Any one of these things, you know, they're big. And so those also can stress, and sometimes they use the term, there's the program I work when life is stable, and then there's like a more intense program when there's big challenges going on. So this, and we're going to be working through a blank sheet like this in a little bit. So this was one part of it, and then when we actually had these relapse prevention support groups, we had a couple things that we read through that were a little more in depth, but I'm going to just kind of briefly touch on that. So we would always read the principles and goals because it was just so important to remember that basic principle that, you know, there are predictable warning signs that precede relapse. You know, relapse can be predicted, and that relapse can be prevented if you can recognize the warning signs and manage them early. And then your goal is to identify your relapse warning signs, learn how to recognize them as they occur. You know, that's so key, as they occur. And three, learn how to manage them without food. So a little later, I'm going to pan these out and ask you to kind of read through them. But one of the things to think about when you read through possible relapse warning signs are first your thoughts. Like, how do these apply to me? Like, think, oh, does that make sense? Does that apply to me? The second is, what emotional reactions are of you when I hear these? Because sometimes if you just start to tense up or feel some emotion, that's an indicator, that's information from your body that there's something to relate to there. And then actions, what behaviors do I need in order to manage these warning signs? What are the tangible things I need to do? And sometimes they'll use the shortcut TFA, thoughts, feelings, actions. What am I thinking? How does it make me feel? What actions do I have to take? And so I'm going to read this from here. When the individual, him or herself, must maintain disciplines that ensure abstinence, sure, there are ways in which others can help. Nearly every person close to the food addict is able to recognize behavior changes that indicate a return to the old way of thinking. And that's also really key, that it's so much easier to do this in community. You know, my partner, she knows a lot about me. I give her permission if she sees stuff to tell me. A lot of people, you give them permission to mirror what we may not be able to see ourselves. Often these individuals and fellow OA members have tried to warn the subject who may by now maybe not be willing to be told. She or he may consider it nagging or a violation of privacy. There are many danger signs. And here's the key thing. Most food addicts, if approached properly, will be willing to go over an inventory of symptoms periodically with either a spouse, a sponsor, an OA buddy, a friend, to just periodically make a process of kind of going through this. If the symptoms are caught early enough and recognized, the food addict will usually try to change his or her thinking, quote, to get back on the beam. It's suggested you consider doing this weekly, it could be doing monthly, but to periodically just kind of, you know, just like you're taking your car for a monthly maintenance, you look at your program for checks, because it's subtle, you know, it starts subtle, and so much easier to catch it early than later. So this is the list that this person who studied addiction theory came up with, and then there's a list that actually OA came up with about 20 years ago. They're kind of similar, but I'm going to just read through them because the more ways you see it, you know, whatever clicks for you is what clicks. It's not like there's a right way to look at this. Exhaustion, allowing yourself to become overly tired or poor health. And I can just say, if you're exhausted, it's so easy to make poor choices on food, just so easy. It could be biologically exhausted from low sleep or psychologically exhausted. Dishonesty, the pattern of being, begins with patterns of unnecessary little lies with friends, fellows, and eventually yourself. Just kind of lying to yourself, like me telling myself an onion ring was okay. Just many forms of dishonesty. Impatience, things are not happening fast enough. I can remember having slower weight losses and things, you know, just being impatient, when is this going to work? Argumentativeness, arguing small and ridiculous points of view. Depression, and you know, depression's, for me, I think many, if you're really depressed, it's so hard to do anything. Frustration at people, and also because things are not going your way. Self-pity. Why do these things happen to me? Why must I be a food addict? I've had periods of just self-pity. Why did I lose my marriage? Why did I have a mother that was like this? Why didn't I have a father? It's so easy to look at things and say, this isn't fair. Like, this is not fair. And it isn't, you know. It isn't like life's not fair. It sucks, but life's not fair, you know. It just isn't, you know, by any definition of fair. Let's see, cockiness, got it made. I had some of that when I got to Goldway and worked through the steps. It's easy, like, oh, wow, look at me. I'm a 34 waist. I'm this, I'm that, you know, and you just get cocky. Or complacence, you know, same thing. Expecting too much from others. You know, sometimes when I've changed, I expect others. I even have a partner now, like, why doesn't she get it? I model good emotional health. Why doesn't she get it? You know, and she's, you know, like, she should be different. Letting up on disciplines, which is a big part of what we talked about. Using other mood-altering chemicals, wanting too much, just sort of wanting too much from life, forgetting gratitude. I can't speak enough for the power of gratitude, you know, just the more you, there's lots of good and bad things out there by any definition, but by focusing on the positive ones, it just helps, you know, in so many ways. They're starting to understand why it helps, but it totally helps. Let's see, it can't happen to me. This is dangerous thinking, you know, it's sort of like, I remember thinking, seeing other people going into relapse, going, oh, but that won't happen to me, you know, and then all of a sudden, after 10 years in OA, I'm back at 280 pounds. Like, it did happen to me. How does this happen? Omnipotence, which is similar to just feeling complacent. Oh, louder, sure. Okay, isolation. Isolation is a large part of disease. Have you physically or emotionally removed yourself from others? You know, that in our readings, it says this is a disease of isolation, you know, and I really think it's a disease of isolation, and it's recovery of community, it's recovery of connectedness. So those are the lists that we came out, and then this is what OA came up with in 1991. This is verbatim. I don't know if they still make this pamphlet. It's called Recovery Checklist, but it's on their website, and you'll be getting one here. Let's see. We have no more power over food today than we attended our first OA meeting. There are many emotional and spiritual symptoms that can be present long before we take the first compulsive bite. Compulsive eating is cunning. Slight changes in our attitude and actions can occur, and the disease might take hold again before we know it. Using this checklist could help us identify these changes. Here's an opportunity to evaluate our program of recovery. And you know, it's funny because we talk about the fourth step inventory. In many ways, this is really just an inventory of our program and our life. It kind of falls in that concept. Are you obsessed with food, diet, and calories? Are other things in your life more important than recovery? And you know, I always say that, you know, my abstinence and mental well-being has to be like the base of my life. Like, if there's, it doesn't matter what else is going on when I'm living off of pizzas in a dark basement, Who cares about anything else? Just who cares about anything else? Do you accept compulsive overeating as a disease and you're powerless over food? You know, it's so important to just remember that, you know, that it really is. It's just my brain is just not right on food. I have one candy bar and I am off to the races. I've never had one candy bar in my life, like not once, you know. Do you feel burned out? Are you rebelling against the program? Are you rationalizing foods that were once questionable? And that's such a big one, that rationalization. Are you concentrating on the spiritual and emotional aspects of the program as well as the physical? You know, like this program has to be looked at from several different buckets all the time. Are you working the program alone or do you have a sponsor? Have you worked all the steps? Do you think once was enough? Are you clinging to a concept of a higher power that no longer works for you? Are you making an effort to maintain conscious contact with that higher power? Do you use prayer and meditation daily? Are you reluctant to let go of old ideas? Are you finding reasons not to attend as many meetings as you once felt you needed? That's such an easy one to measure too, because you know, you know, did I go to one meeting this week or two or three? Are you forgetting to practice slogans such as one day at a time or easy does it? Are you uncomfortable about your weight gain? I also find that, you know, weight doesn't lie. Like I weigh myself just once a week, no matter what, whatever else is going on, Monday morning, you know, and I've been doing that for many years and I have like a 20-year log, you know, and so like it just doesn't lie, you know. Are you using laxatives or purging or compulsive exercise to control? Just one other side note. I was a compulsive exerciser at one point in my disease. I was literally going to the gym three times a day. I remember having my pulse at 180 beats per minute for 3.5 hours continuously. I literally dropped 14 pounds of weight in one session. It was all water weight, but you know, insane exercise is a whole other disease. Do you feel and accept your feelings? Are you focusing on the negative? Are you being judgmental? Are you accepting other people in life in general? Are you reluctant to ask for help? And that's such a big one. Are you reluctant to ask for help? I mean, I feel like the three magic words of OA are, I need help. You know, I need help, you know. One thing that always stuck with me, one of my first sponsors said, he said, if you thought about the world as a big pie chart, everyone needs help, like everyone needs help, we all do. But then if you thought of the people that are aware they need help, it's like a smaller slice. And then the people that are aware they need help and actually ask for help is like even a smaller slice. And then the ones that know they need help and actually ask for help and actually ask for help from the right source, you know? Because you can say, oh my God, I'm fat, what should I do? And you'd like ask somebody and they say, well, switch brands of potato chips, you know, or something like that. You know, they give you some really bad advice, you know? And then finally, to know you need help, ask for help. Ask for help from the right source, and then take the help, accept the help. That's like the smallest slice. And my sponsor said, if you do that, you will be abstinent. You ask for help. You ask for help from the right source, and when you get the help, you take it. He goes, just, and this, it always stuck in my mind for like 28 years or something. And then, can you accept love and forgive yourself? And it says, as you use this checklist, keep in mind that there are no right or wrong answers. It's suggested that you share your response with an OA sponsor. And so again, I'll be giving you copies of this, but I just wanted you to kind of have an overview of it. Okay, so if we could just sort of come back together. And so I'm going to pass out another thing and then also describe how we're going to do it. But the next 20 minutes will be a writing exercise. And there you go. You can just take some of these. There you go. And if you could just pass these out. And just pass these out. And okay, and so this is a 6-step process. So, and the steps are listed there, but I'll walk through them. This is the one that looks like this.
Oh.
It's going around.
Yeah, relapse prevention workshop.
Yeah, it's called relapse prevention workshop. It's the one with a big blank chart with a bunch of blank boxes. So the first thing we'll do is to review that example sheet. I'll ask you to do it on your own, that example sheet I gave you. The example sheet is the one that I call this. It's full of the examples. So just kind of read through the example sheet. The second thing is to read through the relapse warning sign checklist. That's this one. That's the double-sided thing. Actually, just take the time to read through it. And as you read through these things, if it hits a note for you, just, you know, make a point and mark it up. These are yours to keep. But, you know, just take note. And then after you've gone through the examples and the warning sign checklist, write down the warning signs you recognize in yourself. And you could do it a couple of ways. You could just use this grid, and you could do it this way, in kind of like a shorthand note. Or you could actually write them out in more of a narrative on the back or another piece of paper. But the whole goal of this is that you say, wow, I'm starting to go to less meetings. I'm really not accounting for the fact that I now have elder care. I'm really not looking about the fact that my kid just left the empty nest, or, you know, whatever your things are, to just write them out. So at the end of this, give it about 20 minutes, you have a good sense of what your own relapse warning signs are. As well as that, the next thing is to, if there's any things that are relapse warning signs for you but aren't on this list, write them down as well. We're all unique. You know, for you, whatever, you know, pollen might be a relapse warning sign because it's the allergies, or, you know, certain weather or whatever, anything that triggers you, full moons, you know, whatever it is, right? And then the next thing is create an action plan to manage your warning signs. And so, you know, an action plan might be, I'm not getting to enough meetings. I will go to more meetings. I don't call my sponsor very often. I will call my sponsor daily. I will call my sponsor every other day. You know, you actually make a plan that you will act on to mitigate that relapse warning sign. So that's number 5. And number 6, and this is a really key one, note the support you will need to work your action plan. Be specific: who, what, when, where. Find accountability support from sponsors and others. So, for example, suppose you're only going to one meeting a week, and you think, oh, I really need to go to two meetings a week, but like you're like, but I've already got plans. You know, support is like you're going to call someone and talk to them and make a commitment. Maybe you'll go with them, but you'll actually have some support and accountability. Suppose you're going to stop eating in a certain restaurant, but it's kind of your favorite restaurant, so, but you just need to talk it through with someone. So if you think it's something that you can't just naturally do with your own best efforts, then figure out, how can I get support? Support is typically just another human being. Maybe you text to them. A friend of mine now, she always binges when she goes by 7-Elevens. So she like texts me before 7-Eleven is coming up, just saying, will not binge. I get these little texts through the day. And she's not binged. I don't mind getting these little texts, you know. So you just find some, you look for support to do it. So any questions? Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. Are you expecting us to do all 1 through 6 in the next 20 minutes? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, so over...
say to people, that's like the. This looks like just from one, right? So if you need more paper for 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah, and it may take well more than that to thoroughly do this, so this may just be a start, you know, and particularly if you want to put a lot of narrative about things, that's fine. But as much as you can, just sort of start with like bullets to get the key ideas. You can always write through. You could just say fuzzy restaurant behavior, you know, and then later on you can lay out the 5 types of restaurants and the 5 types of fuzz, you know.
It